And our first speaker now is Maria Avila from Mexico, that is going to talk about the Afro-descendants from Mexico.
Thank you. Thank you, Luis. Thank you for the invitation. It's a huge pleasure to be here and share with you this project. I think the previous two talks were perfect to set the stage for this talk of mine. So to frame a little bit the motivation behind this work, I'm very interested in studying the changes in genetic diversity of the Mexican population through time. So I use this cartoon figure to show how in Mexico we can think of genetic diversity in the population in the past going through a massive bottleneck after colonization, and then increasing genetic diversity again through admixture with European and African populations. So I'm very interested in understanding this process through time, and we know that a very standard approach, as we've seen, is taking present-day populations and making inferences about the past, but we can also use ancient populations, kind of try to investigate really the extent of genetic diversity in the past, so that's one of my motivations in my group, and because pathogens played a crucial role in the decrease of population size, I'm also very interested in studying pathogens. But today I'll tell you more about this, what in my opinion is an understudied aspect of our genetic structure, which is the contribution of the African genetic pool to Mexicans. So to put in context as well, we are more than familiar with these admixture plots. So back in 2014, when Andres Moreno Estrada published this very comprehensive work describing the genetic structure of Mexico, here are Africans, Europeans, native Mexicans or indigenous populations from Mexico, and what he called in his paper cosmopolitan samples, so these are populations from like main cities in Mexico. So he made a very beautiful work kind of characterizing in depth the native components, the blue component here in Mexico, and show its structure, and a little bit on the European, but he didn't touch on the African aspect of it. And I was like, why can't we do that? I think we have a rich history there. And he said, well, we have very little African, but yeah, it's very little, but it's everywhere, right? We cannot neglect that. And if we focus on these two populations, Veracruz and Guerrero, we see a little bit more of these green ones. So I was like, why don't we try to explore more of this green component in populations from these places? And another motivation, well, when I started this project, the National Census didn't even consider Afro-Mexicans as a minority group. But now we know, thanks to a National Census in 2020, that around 2% of the Mexican population self-identified as Afro-descendant, and they were only recognized in the Constitution in 2019. And because of this and the legacy of the slave trade, these communities suffer from discrimination, poverty, and marginalization. So thanks to this census, we know that precisely populations from Guerrero and its neighboring state in Oaxaca have one of the highest percentages of people who self-identify as Afro-descendant. And another place that pops up is Veracruz, if you remember from that plot from Andres Moreno's paper. He also had like higher green values in Veracruz. So I was very interested in exploring that African component. Particularly, there is a region between Guerrero and Oaxaca that is called the Costa Chica, where anthropological studies have defined that or identified higher or populations with a higher African ancestry as well. So I went on to explore these places. And also, well, we know this is a legacy of the transatlantic slave trade. So Paul did a great job describing this to you before. But something that I have always noticed, and it was also in the map that he showed, is that the arrows pointing to Mexico sometimes are missing, very often are missing. So this is a few of the one example of the few that exist that actually has an arrow pointing to Mexico. But actually the slave trade was very, very intense to New Spain for a short period of time. but it was very, very heavy. So we have an estimate between 200 and 250,000 African forcibly being taken from the coasts of Africa to the port of Veracruz in Mexico. So another thing to consider is, although there is like this very rich record on historical records on ports of embarkation and disembarkation, those ports do not necessarily reflect the origin of the peoples, right? So the fact that they embarked here doesn't mean that they were exactly from that place. There was a lot going on inside Africa as well. So this was kind of to paint like the context and the possible questions. And another thing that's worth considering, this is a table showing during the colonial times in Mexico, the estimates of European, African, and Native populations. Maybe you don't see the numbers, but what I always like to highlight is that for at least 200 years, or around 200 years, there were more people of like African peoples than Europeans. And of course, that mixed population increased through time, but it's very important to note that there were many more Africans than Europeans in the first 150 years of colonial Mexico. So, and all of these are arguments to kind of convince of the value and the potential legacy of the slave trade into Mexico. And to me, it was very surprising to learn how little this population was studied. And well, there are a lot of sociopolitical, historical reasons for that. So I set up this Afro-Mexico Genomics Project when I was still a postdoc at Stanford. So the goals I set for this project were to characterize African genetic ancestry in the Afro-descendant population in Mexico and contribute to the understanding of their history and origins in Africa. I was very interested in the origins, and maybe identify potential functional consequences of the admixture process. And of course, very important was to contribute to the recognition in Mexico. So here I show you some of the fieldwork sites. We went to both Veracruz and places in Costa Chica. And we visited different communities and also in an indigenous community in Costa Chica, kind of to have a point of comparison with indigenous populations there. So we gave informative talks, we described the project and its goals, and we did Q&A sessions with participants and discussed the letter of consent. And it was we tried to make it like very, like to have a lot of engagement from participants. So those who agreed to participate in total were 380 individuals, mostly females, mostly women, and we genotyped them in an Illumina array called MEGA. Most of the participants self-identified as Afro-descendants using different labels like Afro-Mexican, Afro-descendant, Afro-indigenous, but also labels like Negro or Negra, which is black male or female, and Moreno, which is dark-skinned. And the rest were kind of half and half indigenous and mestizo. So this is just a word cloud. When we asked them how they self-identified, this was an open question. So we used that answer to kind of make this word cloud. And the outstanding word is negra, which is a black woman, which reflects that most of the participants were women and Afro-Mexican. So we collected saliva and also some anthropometric measurements, including height and weight, skin pigmentation, and we took, with their permissions, photos and video, and we also carried out some ethnographic interviews, which will be relevant later. So with these interviews, some of the things we gather were quotes like this. We want to know the root. This is, of course, translated from Spanish. We want to know the root of the black race, where it descended from. Why did they get here? How did they arrive? Because we are newer, but we don't know from where. We're just black. So this is just to reflect that this is not just my interest. There's also interest in the community to learn about their origins. So jumping quickly to the first results, we could characterize using this genotype the mitochondrial haplogroups. So we break them down here by continental ancestry, so European in blue, red native, and yellow African. So one first thing we can notice is that while in Veracruz we have some fraction of African haplogroups, we see almost none in the Costa Chica. In fact, we, and this is of course unrelated individuals, we only see, I think it was just one individual in Oaxaca, from Costa Chica in Oaxaca, who had an African haplogroup group, and the predominant by far is the native component. So this is what this is telling us, is that to the Costa Chica at least, probably not many women arrived, or if they did, they didn't leave many descendants. But we see the opposite when we look at the Y chromosome lineage. So we actually see very important proportions of African haplogroups in Guerrero and Oaxaca, and something that was interesting, although it, here it's a small sample size in the indigenous community, which is a, it's called Chatino, the population. Even there, we see some African haplogroups, and we see none in Veracruz, right? And of course, this can be a bit biased because we had fewer males in the study, but still, this was a, it showed a striking difference. So again, this reinforces this idea that it was mostly males or men who went or were forcibly taken to Costa Chica for forced labor. And regarding the autosomal data, well, we have, again, our admixture plot with Mexicans from LA, Peruvians, Europeans, East Asians, and Africans. And at K4, we see in Costa Chica and Veracruz, we see way higher values of this green African component compared to the Mexicans from the South from the Thousand Genomes Project. And these are indigenous from Andres Moreno's study, and Chatina, which is indigenous group. We have some European as well here, but we see that the Afro-Mexicans from Costa Chica and Veracruz, we see way more of this green component. But the predominant one is almost always the indigenous component. If we increase the K to 6, that's when in Africa we see this first differentiation between groups in West Africa and Yoruba and well, from Nigeria, and here we start to see something interesting, which is the Afro-Mexicans from Costa Chica kind of keep this green color with some of this, I don't know, salmon, whereas the ones from Veracruz, I don't know if you can tell apart the colors, but they start showing more of this salmon color. So here we saw for the first time that there was maybe a difference between the Afro-Mexicans from Veracruz and Costa Chica. And we leveraged the information, the local ancestry information, to dig deeper into this, and Paul did an excellent job describing what the potential of working with local ancestry. I just wanted to show you how some of these cariograms painted by ancestry look like in some participants. So this is an indigenous participant, and you can see that their chromosomes are mainly red, which is the indigenous, the color we use for the indigenous ancestry. This is a mestizo individual where you can see different colors, so indigenous, European, and African. And this was a participant who self-identified as negro or negra. And you see more of the green aspect, the green color. So we, what we did was just take the green color from this participant and do some analysis. And a limitation that we found, before I jump into this, a limitation that we found was that we had these reference panels from Africa, but they were in different genotyping arrays. And when we intersected these, I mean, this is a classical problem in PopGen. When you intersect these panels, you end up with very little sites. So what we wanted to maximize the number of populations. So we used this approach, and this was done by Juan Esteban Rodriguez, a brilliant student who's in the audience right now. And we leverage this method developed by Alex Ioannidis that is called Multiple Array Ancestry Specific MDS. And you can check the publication for more details, but basically you can use multiple arrays and measure, kind of get an estimate of the distances between individuals, combining information from different intersect sets of your data set and reference panels. But what we showed in this was by taking just the green segments of Afro-Mexicans from Veracruz and Costa Chica and overlapping them with the reference populations from Africa. In circles, you have the Costa Chica, and in squares, the ones from Veracruz. So here you could also see that they cluster like separately. So this was another indication of different potential sources of these groups. The colors correspond to the colors here in the map in Africa, and as expected, they fall within West African populations. If we do a zoom here, we see again here the circles and the squares. And another way to visualize this is using these kernel plots, where you kind of draw the distributions of the populations. So we see that the Costa Chica and the Veracruz, they look very different, like the distributions are very different. And the populations, they overlap, they're also different. There's not like a single population they overlap with, but we can see that Costa Chica is more towards this, like Mali and Burkina Faso, so it's west, but more like inland, but also Sierra Leone, which is, of course, west here. And Veracruz has more affinity to populations here, like Nigeria, and some populations here in the like central west, or towards the central west of Africa. And this is also consistent with historical accounts. So we know that Africans were brought to Costa Chica for forced labor during the first years of the transatlantic slave trade, during this intense period of the trade, and then they remain isolated. And the slave trade into Mexico decreased drastically in the mid-17th century. And so those populations kind of remain isolated and didn't receive more Africans, whereas Veracruz was a more dynamic place where Africans or Afro-descendants kept arriving not only from Africa, but also from the Caribbean. So in Veracruz, there were more kind of gene flow and admixture happening. And also, it was very different from what Paul just described. So there were not the marriage, like interracial marriage was not restricted. It was very common, and it was sometimes, so if an African, woman and an indigenous men could have kids and they would be free. So in the descendants of indigenous peoples after some time in the colony were free. They weren't slaves. So it actually happened a lot. It was way more prominent than in many other places. So this is consistent with all these observations. So another thing we wanted to do was kind of use this method also developed by Simon, who's here, which is called TRACTS, to kind of model the admixture timings. And we saw also, we found that the models that best fit the data were also different between Costa Chica and Veracruz. So for Costa Chica, we have the best model involve a first admixture between African and Europeans, and then a pulse by native Mexicans or indigenous Mexicans. Whereas in Veracruz, it involved first European and native or indigenous Mexicans, and then an African pulse. However, we weren't very happy with these models either. Like, even though these had the highest likelihood, we still see that they don't fit the data quite well. So same as Paul, we think that the admixture process was way more complex. So we still have to dig into that. I think we have to try different things for really resolving that. So in of this part, in summary, we've identified the extent of African genetic ancestry in Mexicans of African descent from Afro-descendants in Costa Chica and Veracruz. These uniparental markers point to these sex bias patterns of migration within Mexico. And when digging deeper on the subcontinental origins, we see that we can tell apart the sources in Veracruz and Costa Chica. And this, again, it's very valuable because not only have we kind of neglected this African ancestry in Mexico for very negative reasons, but by neglecting that, we are kind of erasing all these richness of diversity that exists within that soul component, right? So I think we really need to dig more into that and recognize the richness of this component. And well, this admixture model also shows some differences, although I think there's a lot of work to do in that direction to really capture how admixture was happening in these two groups. And in the last few minutes, I want to talk about more of the interaction with participants, how it happens, because I think that sometimes we forget that aspect in these meetings. We just focus on the science, but these are people with life histories we're talking about. So something, this is another quote we got. So many have come and they tell us, and they refer to researchers, we have to identify what part of Africa you are from, but they don't return. While they are in the way of learning and knowing, one hosts them, or the researchers here, but once they take all, they don't come back. And I think this is really a pity, right? We heard many of these accounts during our fieldwork, like, yeah, scientists have come or doctors have come and they take samples, but they never learn what they did with the results. And I think that's pretty damaging, and that's a shame. So we of course didn't like this model. We wanted to return the results. So we returned some genetic ancestry results. Basically what we returned was the karyogram, using color codes to make it easier to interpret. And we didn't give estimates like 50%, 24%. We avoid at all costs giving numbers to participants, because first we know there's a margin of error in those estimates, and second, we don't want people to compare themselves using numbers. So we wanted to make it very visual, so just using colors. And also the maternal and paternal lineages in male participants, and because in the first visit we took pictures of them, we returned their genetic ancestry results together with their pictures. And they were very pleased with that. And the reactions the participants had, these are some quotes, because we also carried out ethnographic interviews afterwards, after returning results, where people are learning that the roots are not from here, that's fine, I feel good, I am learning where my blood comes from. We come from Africa, that's why we are Morenos Blacks. So these are some of the reactions, and I think this is important to have in mind, that our studies, they can have impact on people. So yes, these are some common reactions: surprise, the strengthening the sense of belonging, mainly in Costa Chica, and people would try to make sense of these results by bringing up a lot of family history of origins and migrations, stories they've heard from their grandfathers and grandmothers. And it was very enriching for the project, at least for me as a researcher, to interact with people this way. And they were quite often trying to kind of make sense of the results by bringing up their traits as well, or their phenotypes, or of those of their relatives, like if they saw, for example, an indigenous mitochondrial lineage, that they had an indigenous mitochondrial lineage, even though they self-identified as Afro-Mexican, they could be like, oh yeah, my grandmother spoke an indigenous language, or had this very straight and dark hair. And always bringing up like phenotypes was a very interesting feature. So something that we want to do next is leverage this phenotype information, especially the skin pigmentation part, and study the genetics of this. So with that, I would like to end, acknowledging all participants, of course, and people who've helped in the field, and a lot of collaborators and funding for this project. And I'm happy to take questions.